Well, good evening. Welcome back to our study of the book of Daniel. I'm glad you're here. Just a reminder, do this every time, but it's on your handout. For those of you online, it should be on the handout online, but there's the number that you can text your questions to, and we try to answer as many as we can. And so as we get into the prophecy, I'm kind of expecting, you know, you'd have some interesting questions, which I probably can't answer, but I'll tell you, I've always had this deal. I've told some of you this before, but you should feel free to ask any question you want in this class, and I will feel free to make up any answer that I want. Okay? I feel like that's a fair deal, all right? Well, let me say a prayer for us, and we're going to dive in. Lord, thank you for the country in which we live, and we can come together and worship. I thank you, Father, for the freedom that we have. I thank you for this place that provides us such a comfortable place to study your word. I pray that you would take this into our minds and our hearts and that it would make its way out through our hands in this world. I pray for the leaders of this world that you would turn their hearts to you. We know that you are sovereign in all things, but I pray, Father, that you would bring them toward peace. In Christ's name, amen. Well, we are in the second half of the book of Daniel. You remember the first half. Chapters 1 through 6 are events in the life of Daniel. And in fact, I just have a little slide with some key dates. So if you remember, this is all review, but in 605 BC, Daniel and some of the other young Jewish men were probably teenagers taken back to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. So they began to be trained, and they were going to become civil servants in the Babylonian Empire. In 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, and not just destroyed it, dismantled it, because several times between 605 and 586, the Jewish king said, well, we're going to pay you tribute, we want peace, we'll be good subjects, and they weren't. And so finally, Nebuchadnezzar says, enough of this, and I'm going to make an example of you. And he did. And so he destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, took most of the Jews into exile into Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq. So he took most of the Jews into Iraq. 553 is near the end. This is the last king of Babylon. Nabonidus and his son Belshazzar, whom you're going to hear about Belshazzar, they ruled Babylon from 553 until 539 BC when it fell. Two of the visions, because the second half of Daniel are visions that he had, two of the visions, chapter 7 and tonight's chapter 8, occur right around this time, 553 BC, when Belshazzar comes to think. The Babylonians at this point have had bad kings since Nebuchadnezzar, and they're just not prospering. This is going to sound so modern, but they're military had gotten weak. Their economy, they'd frittered away some money. Inflation was a problem. I mean, the exact same things that happen today happen in ancient cultures as well. And so they're financially weak, they're militarily weak, and they've got some very opportunistic neighbors that are wanting to take their land. And so Daniel receives some visions of the future, of future events. Then in 539, Babylon was conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire. And this, we think of this as Cyrus the Great is the most famous. And these two visions in chapter 9 and chapters 10 through 12 occur during the Persian era. So if you think about it, Daniel, if he's say, let's say he's 15 years old, just he's somewhere in that vicinity when he comes in 605. So as you can see, the vision in chapter 8, Daniel is going to be about 70 years old when this happens. And so he's into his 80s here. He lives from the beginning of the Babylonian Empire to the end of the Babylonian Empire, and he never goes home. He never makes it back to Israel, but God uses him in a really powerful way. Then in 538 BC, just as God had promised through the prophet Jeremiah, Cyrus the Persian allows the Jews to return to Jerusalem. And so you do see the first wave of Jews going back to Jerusalem in 538 BC. So one of the questions is, before we jump into the visions, why is God giving Daniel these visions? Daniel's not predicting the future. Daniel doesn't even know what these visions mean, except you're going to see an angel explain it to him. But so he is telling the people what God is telling him, and it happens to be a roadmap of the future. We have the advantage of being able to look back to see how accurate was it. But what was the point of giving? I think there's a point to these visions for the people then and for us now. For the people then, if you think about it, they had been unfaithful to God. God had been warning the Israelites for over 150 years. You know, he was very patient with them. He said, turn back to God. Stop putting your confidence in geopolitical alliances and material wealth. I mean, he could be preaching to people throughout history. He said, put your trust in God. They didn't. And so you see the exile to Babylon, the destruction of Jerusalem. Then the Persians come along and they go back. But here's the question. You know, when they go back, they have the question of, are we still God's people? Is he done with us? Is God, are we kind of on our own now and don't have a very bright future? Well, one of the reasons for these visions was for God to tell the people that he was still sovereign, that Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, fill in the blank with any empire since then, they're not actually controlling events. They're not actually in control of these people's future. God's in control of their future, and that God intends to keep his promises. And that's just as true for us as it was for them. So in chapter 7, Daniel has a vision. Chapter 2, he interpreted a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had of a statue. And if you remember, he told Nebuchadnezzar, this statue, God says that this statue represents four kingdoms. Chapter 7, Daniel saw a vision of these four animals. And these animals, it's explained to him, are the four successive kingdoms that are coming. That you have the Babylonian Empire, followed by the Medo-Persian Empire. I'm just going to call it the Persian Empire. Followed by the Greeks, followed by the Romans. And in this vision, you see that in the time of the Romans, God is going to do something and set up a kingdom that will never end. So the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has 50 years before, and this vision that Daniel has, is a reiteration that God says, I'm going to tell you that of the kingdoms that are coming and what's going to happen to each one of them. Well, that was chapter 7, and here are the kingdoms, and those are the dates, basically, of their ascendancy. It's not the entire dates, but basically Babylon was a power from 626 to 539. And as I say, all of this is known historically. Everything in Daniel ties very nicely to the secular historical record. So we're not really relying on the Bible for these kingdoms at all. This is all a matter of just secular history. The Persian kingdom, 539 to 331. Alexander the Great conquers this part of the world in 331, goes to about 146. And then you see the Roman Empire in its ascendancy. And the Eastern Roman Empire goes all the way into what you would almost call modern times, into the beginning of the Ottoman Empire in Europe. So these are the four kingdoms. This particular vision, chapter 7 laid out this map. This particular vision in chapter 8 happens a couple of years after chapter 7, still when Belshazzar is king, and it's going to focus in on the Persian Empire and the Greek Empire, and God wants to tell the Jews of what is going to happen to them during the time of this Greek Empire. Now remember, that's as far away from them as the founding of America is from us, and yet God is forecasting it. He's saying, this is going to happen in the future. So let's open up chapter 8. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, so the Babylonians, this is 550 BC, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first, chapter 7. And I saw in the vision, and I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. So this is Babylon. And this is the core Babylonia. He is in the province of Elam. And Susa, he says it's a citadel. The Babylonians had a number of capitals. So did the Persians, by the way. They had a number of capitals. And Daniel was pretty high up in the administration. And so he was there on probably official business. He's probably, again, 70 years old at the time that he sees this vision. So the way chapter 8 is broken up, I'm going to skip back and forth, because he has this vision in the first half, and the second half it gets explained to him. So we're going to do it piece by piece, and I'll give you the vision and the explanation that comes afterwards. So he said, I raised my eyes and I saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal, and it had two horns. Both of the horns were very high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue him from his power. He did as he pleased, and he became great. So remember, in what's called apocalyptic literature, this is apocalyptic because it is being revealed to Daniel. And the nature of apocalyptic literature is those revelations tend to come in visions. So what did Daniel actually see? He actually saw an image of some kind of a ram with two horns, one of them greater than the other. Somehow he knew that the greater one had come second, and he's just seeing this, these visions, but he doesn't necessarily know what they mean. And this kind of prophecy is visions that can be decoded. If the scripture decodes it, that's great. If not, there are kind of conventions that you'll see through apocalyptic literature. And one of them is that horns mean power, usually military or economic power, but some kind of earthly temporal power. And the horns usually refer to either a king or the kingdom that that king represents. And so this he begins to see. What he realizes is two kings or two empires in this mighty creature that conquers most of the world. So let's skip forward. And in verse 15, he says, now when I'd seen this whole vision, I sought to understand it, meaning I have no idea what this means. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice saying, Gabriel is one of the archangels. An angel is a messenger of God, and Gabriel is one of the ruling angels. As we get into some future visions, you're going to see that there isn't just a matter of empires fighting empires, that there's spiritual battles going on. And you will be introduced to Gabriel and Michael and some of the angels, which we call fallen angels, demons, exercising their power on Satan's behalf. So in this vision, you begin to get the first realization that this isn't just about earthly kingdoms, that this is also about spiritual things going on behind the scenes. And so the voice said, Gabriel, explain this vision to him. So he came where I stood, and I was frightened, and I fell on my face. But he said, understand this, son of man, human being, that the vision is for the time of the end. So what he's saying is, what I'm telling you now is not something that's going to happen tomorrow. This is God telling you how things are going to play out. And he's telling him how things are going to play out in two ways. And apocalyptic prophecy particularly is like this, is you will end up with a prophecy and you will see a fulfillment in the short term. And at the same time, the prophecy will be talking about the long term. And so we're going to be introduced in this vision to an Antichrist figure. And some of what's talked about here, and this is going to be particularly true in the next two visions, some of what's talked about here is clearly talking about a specific time in history, but just as clearly talking about something more than that. And so this, in Jewish prophecy, this idea that there's multiple fulfillments. And I don't mean it's like you make something up and start looking around for things to fulfill it. There are very specific fulfillments. We're going to talk about a specific king who is an Antichrist figure, and I'll tell you what makes an Antichrist figure. And at the same time, the book of Revelation is going to talk about some of these same things about the Antichrist at the end. So he says to him, these are things of the end. And when he'd spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face on the ground. But he touched me and I stood up, and he said, behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end. of the indignation. This is kind of an abomination. We'll see this translated abomination later. It refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram that you saw with two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. So this, in the other vision, this was the bear, and one side was higher than the other, because in the Median Empire was first, but the Persian Empire overshadowed it. And I've told you before that Cyrus, the Persian king, his father was a Persian. His mother was the granddaughter of the king of Media. And the prophecy about him was that he would bring the kingdoms together and then do great things. And so he became the king of the combined empire. And so that's why you see the two horns coming together in this animal. Cyrus the Great, Cyrus the Persian, is very well known in history. So outside of the Bible, he is a major character. The Persian Empire was a very big empire. This vision isn't primarily about the Persians, so I'm going to move on to the next part of the vision. But Cyrus the Persian was held in very high regard. In fact, you can still today, if you get on Amazon and you look for Cyrus the Persian leadership skills, you will see books today written about how to lead like Cyrus the Persian. Well, I have to say that's a little bit of revisionist history, because he killed a lot of people. And last time I checked, that's against most corporate HR policies. But you get this idea of him being a very successful emperor, a successful king, and he's well thought of throughout history. So Cyrus was a great king. He basically established a very big empire. But what happened next? Daniel says, as I was considering, behold, a goat came from the west. Think Greece, spoiler alert, this is Alexander the Great, and he's coming from the west, across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. The swiftness of Alexander the Great's conquest of the known world to him is unbelievable. He's born in 356. He dies at 33 years old in 323. But when his father dies, he's a young man. He takes over all of the armies. I'll show you the extent of his empire in just a little bit. But he completely dominates the Persian Empire in a period of about 10 years. I mean, it's unheard of. So the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. So this is a horn as a king, and it's very conspicuous. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke the two horns, meaning conquered Persia, the Persian Empire. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram, Persia, from his power. Then the goat, the Greek Empire, became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, the great horn was broken. Alexander, at the peak of his accomplishments, dies of illness when he was 33 years old. So the great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of heaven. There was a lot of animosity between the Greeks and the Persians. Now, this vision is happening in the Babylonian Empire, but now we're going to talk about when is this vision about. So the Persian Empire goes all the way until from 539 to 331. So think a couple of hundred years of rule until Alexander the Great comes about. But in that Persian time, you get Persian kings who think that their god has given them a mandate to rule the whole world. And so in 480 BC, King Xerxes, a descendant of Cyrus the Great, decides he's going to conquer Greece. And if you've ever seen the movie about the Spartans and the 300, that's that time period. That's this Persian Empire. So there's a great deal of animosity between the Greeks and the Persians. And he says, as for the ram you saw, those were the kings of Media and Persia, and the goat is the king of Greece, Alexander the Great. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king, and as for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. And that's exactly what happened. Alexander the Great conquered, I'll show you a map in a minute, it's unbelievable how much of the world that he conquered. But after his death, he had four generals who each carved out a piece of the empire, and they all, each thought they were going to be Alexander, but no one ever was able to consolidate it again. They were not as powerful as Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was very, the Persian and Greek empires were very different, and this is a good thing to think about right now because it's going to play itself out at the time of Jesus. So things that are happening here in these visions and what happened here in history, so we're in 331 BC, are going to heavily affect what happens in the New Testament. And one of the things was this, the Persians were pretty laid back, I mean, if you can call a brutal empire laid back. Laid back in the sense that they let the Jews go home. They didn't export people. They didn't take them into exile. They said, all you people can go back. You just need to pay ridiculously high taxes to us, and don't you even think of rebelling. But they did let them all go back. He said, as long as you pay attention to our gods, you can worship your gods. We really don't care. And for an empire, that's pretty laid back. You actually have, by and large, what we would call religious freedom, by and large, in the Persian Empire. Not so the Greeks. The Greeks thought that they were the cultural pinnacle of the world. One thing, interesting thing you can tell about a culture is how they define themselves in the world. China's a little bit like this, quite a bit like this today, actually. But for example, the Greeks divided the world into Greeks and barbarians, meaning you're either Greek or you're completely uncivilized. And so that's how they thought of themselves, that's how they thought of the world. When Alexander the Great went conquering, he didn't just take armies, he took poets and teachers and philosophers and sculptors and artists. And everywhere Alexander the Great went, he left teachers to begin teaching these barbarians the Greek language, and teaching them Greek culture, teach them about the Greek gods. This is why 300 years later, Jesus comes, your New Testament is written in Greek, because almost everyone can understand Greek because of the dominance of Alexander the Great's empire and the fact that he was so aggressive in spreading Greek culture. Well, that's a very different posture than the Persians had. And this is the heart of this vision, is what's going to happen under the Greek Empire. But let me show you a little bit about Alexander. This is the extent of Alexander's empire. This is a great map because it shows you the things. But look, way into India. I mean, all the way, he came from Macedonia and Greece. All the way through Asia Minor, he conquered Egypt, Iraq, Iran. I mean, he conquered pretty much everything he could. He would have conquered more had he not gotten sick and died at the end. He wasn't through conquering. So Alexander the Great had this massive empire. When he died, it broke into four parts. This map is a little later because the vision is not going to be about Alexander's time. It's going to be a little bit later. And so he had several generals. One was Antigonus. Ptolemy was another general. Seleucus was another general. And so they began to rule these particular areas, and then their son would become king, and his son would become king, and his son would become king. And so they were a dynasty. So that's why it's called the Seleucid Empire, because Seleucus was the first ruler. And everybody else wasn't necessarily named Seleucus, but they were part of that dynasty. Think later, you're going to see the same thing with Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar became the first emperor, and now all the emperors after him took the title Caesar, right? So it's a dynasty. Same with Ptolemy. The last of the Ptolemies ruling Greeks that ruled Egypt was Cleopatra. And so she is obviously dethroned in the time of Augustus, Mark Antony. We'll talk about that when we get there. It's a great love story. Well, it's not a love story, but it's a really good intrigue. She was in the line of Ptolemy, and she was a Greek queen in this line. But this is the meaning of the vision. You get the horn that's strong, it breaks, four horns come up after it. Okay, so let's pause there and we'll go on with the vision. But first, question.
Why are there only three empires?
There are only three there because they didn't show you everybody else. Again, at the time of Alexander, there were four. I fast-forwarded the map a little from 331. This is actually the map of what it looks like in approximately 200 BC, because that's when this vision is going to talk about. So 331, there were four kings. They start fighting each other. By 200 BC, this is what the world looks like. So I just skipped that part.
Okay, going back a little bit in your lesson, the one that it references, the one having an appearance of a man who speaks to Gabriel and commands him to speak to Daniel. Is that pre-incarnate Jesus?
That's a good question, and I'm going to answer this, and every other time you ask it, this is going to be the same answer. I don't mean that badly. I just mean we don't know, but a lot of people think that's exactly what's happening, that Jesus is indeed pre-incarnate. There's no question about that. I mean, John talks about Jesus was, you know, with God at the beginning, that nothing was made that wasn't made through him. No, that's not questionable. Question is, when does Jesus show up in history, basically as God manifest in the world? There's nothing in the text that would tell us whether that's a messenger, and the word angel means messenger, a messenger of God, or if that's Jesus himself. And so theologians will just debate that back and forth as, is that Jesus? Since he's commanding Gabriel, probably is somebody higher than Gabriel, but perhaps not. And so you really can't tell from the text, but many people think so.
So what did the Jews think?
The Jews did not think it was Jesus, I'll tell you that. But they basically thought, in Jewish thought, and this is still true, this is also true in Christian thought as well, is that in the Old Testament, you will see the phrase, the angel of the Lord coming to people. For a great example is Abraham and the visitors. And so at the beginning of this, it's talk about these. He realizes these are the angels of the Lord, and then later he realizes that God had spoken to him. And so you get this little bit of ambiguity. Is it a messenger, or is it actually God speaking? And the answer is kind of yes. I mean, it's not entirely clear. So the Jews did have an idea that God himself would speak directly to them, but also a robust idea that God, Gabriel and Michael and other angels, also would speak for God. So they did have this idea. And consequently, as Christians, we understand then that if indeed it's God, it's entirely likely that it's Jesus, the Son. So it's a good question, but at the end of the day, it's really hard to know for sure because the text just isn't clear enough on that. Okay? So we find ourselves with Alexander the Great. He dies, the other kings come about, and now you're going to have this Greek empire that runs through most of the world. And so this is Daniel's, continues the vision. The goat became exceedingly great, and when he was strong, the horn was broken. I'm repeating a little. So Alexander dies. Then there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven, meaning they took over the kind of worldwide empire. But out of one of those four came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, the east, and toward the glorious land, toward Israel. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was, okay, let me stop there because now we're talking about something a little different. This is interesting because now we're talking about a specific king that's going to come up out of one of those four kingdoms, and it's going to be from the Seleucid Empire. And in fact, there's widespread agreement amongst scholars of all stripes on exactly who this is. And so I'll introduce you to him in just a minute. But the interesting thing, notice what's being said about him. What's being said about him is not just that he's going to be a king, but you start to see spiritual language. He even grew to the host of heaven. Some of the stars it threw down to the ground, which is typically talking about defeating angels and trampling on them. He became great, even as great as the prince of the host, thinking Michael or Gabriel. This isn't necessarily literal that this king was able to fight with Gabriel or Michael, but what it's telling you is this king isn't just a king like Cyrus or Nebuchadnezzar, who was just a king of the earth. This king thought he was a god. He thought he was operating on earthly realm, and he thought he was operating in the spiritual realm as well. This is the essence of an antichrist. Not every evil empire or evil king is an antichrist figure. You could be a good king, you could be a bad king, you could be judged by God. I mean, that's happening all through history. But we reserve the idea of an antichrist as a king who is arrayed against God and against God's people, but also has pretensions of being a god. This is the essence of Satan. When we get to Revelation, you're going to see the great dragon, Satan. That's kind of the image in the visions of Satan, is portrayed as this great dragon. And the idea of Satan is allied against God and against God's people. He was then, he is today, but he wants to be God. And so the interesting thing about this king is, unlike all of the others that are going to come through this 200-year period, this king is going to be an antichrist. This king is going to interfere with the temple worship. And he's going to take away the temple worship. And he is going to take away the regular burnt offerings. And he will throw the truth to the ground. And he will act, and he will prosper. He's going to interfere with the worship, and he is going to fundamentally say, you can't worship God anymore, you have to worship me. If you've read the book of Revelation, you realize this is the hallmark of the Antichrist, is the worship, the demanding that you worship the Antichrist, that you take the mark of the beast, and if you don't have the mark of the beast, then the beast, the Antichrist, is going to wipe you out. This is essentially what an Antichrist is. This king, this historical king, is going to be an Antichrist figure because that's what he's going to do. So, as for the horn that was broken, this is the explanation. Four kingdoms will arise, but not with as much power as Alexander. And at the latter end of their kingdom, and this is true historically, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, meaning he's really proud of himself, he understands riddles, meaning he's politically astute, he will arise. His power will be great, but not by his own. In other words, his power is going to be great, but not because he's a great military leader like Alexander the Great. He's going to be great because Satan is behind him, and Satan is going to lift him up. This is all Antichrist kind of figure. And so he will succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. In other words, he is going to oppress and conquer God's people. This sounds so much like the book of Revelation, but this is talking about a specific Greek king. And so he will make deceit prosper, this very satanic idea. And in his, this is great, I love this, in his own mind, he shall be great. And so he is going to set himself up as God. And of course, the image says in his own mind, he thinks he's God. Same thing could be said about Satan. Same thing could be said about the Antichrist. So this is an Antichrist figure. And he will even rise up against the Prince of Princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. It's almost like he's a king who decides he's going to be a god, and he said, I think I can play in the spiritual realm. Why don't you bring on your archangel? Because I have Satan with me, and he's in way above his head. But how this manifests itself is the reason for this vision. So the king we're talking about is a guy named King Antiochus Epiphanes. So you notice he's ruling near the end. So the Greek kingdom starts in 331. They're conquered by the Romans, but in 164, they're actually going to be conquered by the Jews. We'll get to that in a minute. That's the essence of this. But when he starts ruling in 175, and he rules to 164, he is going to do everything he can to stamp out the Jewish religion. And he's going to require everybody in his kingdom to worship him. And let me remind you again of his kingdom. So this is, he is a Seleucid king, Antiochus IV. He is in control at this time. He actually conquers Egypt at one point, but he's in control of Judea and Jerusalem at this time, as well as everything else. And all through his kingdom, he's like, you're welcome to worship your gods, but you have to worship me, and you have to sacrifice to me. In fact, his very name is Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes, this is a great little coin, so you probably can't see it, but here's what it, this is in Greek, and what it says is, King Antiochus, the very image, the epiphany of God, victory bearer, meaning, if you've seen me, you've seen God. That's interesting. Who else said that? Jesus said that, didn't he? Well, this is before that time. He's saying, if you've seen me, you've seen God. That's how cool I am. And I go from victory to victory to victory. I win all the time because I'm just so awesome and so magnificent. And so he has this image of himself. He believed that he was indeed a manifestation of the gods. And he required everyone to worship him. And this happened all through their kingdom. So when I said earlier that Alexander was aggressive with Greek culture, and he wanted to make sure everybody knew the Greek language and Greek culture, well, over time, it got even more intense with people like Antiochus. He said, you need to worship me. Greek's going to be the official language. You cannot worship your gods. And so the Jews were the people that would not do it. By and large, you'll see in a minute that many Jews did. But fundamentally, the reason that he tried to stamp out the Jewish religion is because there were a lot of Jews that would not sacrifice to him and would not worship him. I mean, the parallels here with Christians are throughout history are very interesting. That's not what this vision is about, but let me go back to this map. Have you ever noticed that right here, God's people, the Jews, they are not geopolitically important. Don't have a big army, don't have a lot of oil to run the tanks, they don't have anything big, and yet they are at the crux of world events. Why? Because this empire is fighting this empire, and they go back and forth. That's been true throughout all of history. And so God's people are in the center of history, they're in the limelight, not because they're trying to conquer anybody. They'd be happy to pay their taxes and be left alone to worship their God. But history hasn't given that to them. They are at the crux. There's a lot of that same similarity with Christians throughout history and even today. Christians are not geographically at the hub in the middle of the battles, but Christians are indeed in the middle of the culture wars. You have the great movement of Islam in the East. You have the various empires in the Far East. You have a very aggressive secular humanism, kind of what you think of as wokeness today, a very aggressive secular humanism. And here you have Christians. I mean, stop and think about this for a minute. Why would you want to make war on the Christians if you were secure in your beliefs? Let's just say you're a secular humanist and you go, look, I don't believe in you. You're God. I don't believe in Jesus. But you know what? You guys are pretty nice people. And you really don't do a lot of bad stuff. In fact, you're kind of good citizens to have around. So I don't really have any heartburn with you. But that's not the way it's playing out, is it? Christians are at the center of the culture wars, just to use a phrase that's used a lot. And I would just say that what happened geographically then is happening ideologically now. So the difference between Antiochus and a lot of other kings is Antiochus wanted to be worshipped. It wasn't a live and let live. It wasn't pay your taxes, worship your gods, and at least acknowledge that the Greeks are the best. It was, no, you actually have to worship him. Now I'm going to give you some passages out of books called 1st and 2nd Maccabees. These books are not in your Bible. They're in the Catholic Bible. These books were written at this time about these events that are happening between 175 and 164 BC in history with this King Antiochus. Next, in our next lesson, I'd like to talk to you about, at this time, the Jews are writing a lot of stuff. So I want to do a little time out next week and talk to you about what else is going on with the Jews. The Dead Sea Scrolls are being copied now, at this time, right? Second century BC. The Apocrypha, like 1st and 2nd Maccabees, are being written down. They're in the Catholic Bible. They're not in your Protestant Bible. And we talk next week about why, how did that come to be. These are, by and large, these two books, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, are historical books. And they describe what happened in the reign of Antiochus. So 1st Maccabees says this: King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people. When he says one people, what does he mean? You guys should all worship me. And that each should forsake his own laws, and all the nations agreed according to the word of the king, and many of Israel consented to his worship. Even a lot of the Jews said, okay, we don't want to be killed. Let's just worship the guy and get on with our life. And they sacrificed to the idols and profaned the Sabbath. So the key things for Jews, the key, I mean, there are 613 commandments in the Torah, right? And you've got the 10 commandments that are the biggies, so to speak. But there are certain key markers of being a Jew. One of them is observance of the Sabbath, that you do no work on the Sabbath. The other is you do not sacrifice to idols. You shall have no other gods before me. Circumcision of your children is the sign of the covenant relationship with God. So even if you don't keep the kosher laws, even if you eat pulled pork sandwiches and cheeseburgers and you don't follow all the laws, these were fundamental markers of what it meant to be a Jew. That's why they are mentioned here. Is there people that are fundamentally abandoning the essence of their Jewishness? It's not like they just won't keep all the commandments. They're fundamentally abandoning who they are. And so the king sent letters that they should follow the laws and should forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice. In other words, you can't serve your God at all in the temple, in the sanctuary. You should profane the Sabbath and pollute the sanctuary. In other words, he had sacrifices made in the temple of unclean animals. And like, I don't care about your God. I'm the only God. We're going to sacrifice to me in your temple. You couldn't get more offensive to the Jews than that. And so, and whoever will not do the word of the king will be killed. And according to all these words, he wrote to his whole kingdom, and he appointed overseers over all the people and commanders of the cities of Judah to sacrifice city by city. So what he did was he would send some of his soldiers and a representative city by city, and they would set up an altar, and they would have one at a time. The men would come up and sacrifice to Antiochus, and that was their domination. This is an antichrist figure. Think of Cyrus. Cyrus never made anybody worship him. It's sort of, you can worship your God, you just pay me taxes and obey me. This is not just, I want to rule, I demand your allegiance as a God. 1 Maccabees again. And the king's officers that were enforcing the apostasy came to the city of Modin to sacrifice. They set up a little altar, and many of Israel came to them. And there was a man named Mattathias and his sons, and they were gathered together. And the king's officers spoke to Mattathias, saying, "You are a ruler, an elder, and an honorable and great man in this city, and strengthened with sons and relatives. Now, therefore, you come first and do the command of the king, as all the other nations have done, and the men of Judah will see you doing this, and they also will fall into line." They're like, well, if Mattathias, who's a very devout man, is willing to do this, I guess we will as well. And Mattathias answered and said in a loud voice, "If all the nations that are in the house of the king's dominion listen to him, to each one fall away from the worship of his fathers and have made that choice to follow his commands, I and my sons and my relatives will walk in the covenant of our fathers. Heaven forbid that we should forsake the law and the ordinances. We will not listen to the king's words to go aside from our worship on the right hand or on the left." And making that speech, his life was forfeit. I mean, he was going to be killed. This is a great picture of that scene in kind of a, you know, late Middle Ages kind of a thing, is the showdown. And you can just imagine the tension there when Mattathias is willing to say, "I'm not going to sacrifice. And if you want to do something, here I am. Here are my sons. Here are my relatives. You're going to have to come after us and kill us." Now, when he had finished speaking these words, there came a certain Jew in the sight of all to sacrifice on the altar, which was at Modin. So he says no. Awkward silence follows. Some other Jew says, "Well, I will. I'm not going to risk my life and my family." So he goes up to sacrifice on the altar. And Mattathias saw it, and his zeal was kindled. He was furious, his wrath according to judgment. And he ran and he killed that Jew right there at the altar. He killed the king's officer who compelled the men to sacrifice, and he pulled down the altar. He was zealous for the law. And he said in a loud voice, "Whoever is zealous for the law, whoever's faithful and maintains the covenant, let him come with me." And he and his sons fled into the mountains and left all of their property. This begins a rebellion because they simply will not do that. So he and his family and a small group of people leave because they know that Antiochus is going to send soldiers to find them all and kill them all. One of his sons, his third son, was named Judas. Judas was, I want you to think of Judas as he was the captain of the high school football team. He's a big, burly guy, and he had a nickname, and his nickname was Judas the Hammer. I mean, he's a strong guy, he's a powerful guy, and that word is Maccabeus. And so Judas Maccabeus, Judas the Hammer. And he emerges, I'm going to really shorten this story, but they begin to rebel in 167, and they end up winning, spoiler alert, in 164. It takes them 3 years of fighting. They end up expelling the Greeks out of there, and I'll tell you why in a minute. And so this idea of a successful rebel, I already told you that the Greek language led to your New Testament being in Greek. This successful rebellion by Judas Maccabee informs, 164 later, informs Jewish thinking about what a Messiah should be. So you remember when Jesus comes, they're like, "Are you going to get an army now and throw off the Romans?" What are they thinking? Judas Maccabee did that. He threw off the Greeks. And so that's their image of what the Messiah would be like. So sometimes we ask, well, how did they miss the Messiah? Do they not know that he was also going to be suffering servant like Joseph? They knew all those prophecies, but in their recent memory, they had seen God raise a man up, kind of like Samson or somebody else in the Old Testament, and pushed them away, that the faithful Jews conquered their oppressors. And so they had this paradigm in their mind. And so I want you to, when you read the New Testament, they're informed by this, by their thinking of the Messiah. Also, if you read the New Testament, you'll realize there were other people who claimed to be Messiahs, and every single one of them got a band of soldiers and tried to overthrow the Romans. In other words, all the Jews were thinking of a Messiah with that template in their mind. Of course, Jesus comes with a radically different template. So I just want you to see this as kind of having informed that time period. And Maccabeus, Judas, and those who were with him, the Lord leading them on, I'm skipping forward now, recovered the temple and the city. So 3 years of fighting, they actually defeat the armies that are sent against them. They recover the temple and the city. They pulled down all the altars that had been built in the marketplace by the Greeks, and also the sacred enclosures. And having cleansed the sanctuary, they made another altar of sacrifice. So the altar that was made with uncut stones, okay, that were in the temple, they'd sacrifice pigs on that. They've sacrificed things, so they tore it down. And so they rededicate the temple. They make a new altar to God, and they're getting ready to start the sacrifices. And so they offered sacrifices and burned incense and lighted the lamps and set out the bread. These are all the things that are in the law of Moses. They're going to restore the worship of their God. And after they had done these things, they prayed to God that they might no longer fall into such evils, but that if they should ever sin, that should befall them. And you have to remember what Antiochus was doing in this time period. Not only was he saying, you have to sacrifice to me or die, I've left out a ton of stories out of 1st and 2nd Maccabees because they are so gruesome. Historical, but gruesome. So just the tip of the iceberg is, if you circumcised your child, the mother would die and so would the whole family. You would all be killed. If you owned a copy of the Torah, the Old Testament, you would all be killed. You were supposed to turn them all in and they were all burned. You couldn't observe the Sabbath. You couldn't sacrifice at the altar. In other words, he's trying to stamp out the Jewish religion, and the penalty is death. And so he killed so many thousands of Jews, and some of it was pretty gruesome. When you read it, you'll realize, oh my goodness, this was unbelievably horrific persecution of the Jews at that time. But they win. And so he said, now on the same day the sanctuary was profaned, in 167, the same very same day that they had profaned the altar, on the fifth day of Kislev, that's a month in the Jewish calendar, they kept 8 days with gladness. So they basically, on that same day, they rededicated the altar and began worshiping again 3 years later. And so this is a huge moment in Jewish history. And in fact, this moment is commemorated as Hanukkah. This is where Hanukkah comes from. Hanukkah is not in your Old Testament. It is a commemoration of that 8 days that they said, we're going to have a feast for 8 days because we've rededicated it. And so this is 1 Maccabees. And Judas and his brethren said, let's go up to the holy place. Let's rededicate it. And on the morning of the 25th day of the ninth month, which is the month of Kislev, and then it dates it 164 on our calendar. And so basically they made these offerings. They offered burnt offerings with gladness. There was exceeding gladness among the people, and the reproach of the Gentiles was turned away. In other words, they'd made up for the oppression and the sacrilege. And Judas and his brothers and the whole congregation of Israel ordained that the days of the dedication of the altar should be kept year by year for 8 days. So in other words, they instituted this and they said, let's remember what God did in allowing us to conquer them. And so we're going to have an 8-day festival. And to this day, Hanukkah is an 8-day festival. The miracle of Hanukkah, the reason it's celebrated the way it is when they got into the temple, they had a little bit of a problem because you're supposed to keep the lamp burning all the time in the temple. And to do it, they used this consecrated olive oil. You couldn't just go down to, you know, the grocery store, get you some extra virgin olive oil and use that. Had to be blessed, had to be pure, had to be the very first pressing of the olives. I mean, it was a business to give the very best for God. Well, they only had enough of that olive oil for one day, for the lamp to burn for one day. And according to tradition, it miraculously burned for 8 days. And consequently, Hanukkah is called, and by the way, you'll see this menorah. You've got 8 lamps, and then, of course, one to light it from. But you have these 8 lamps, and in Hanukkah, you'll light another lamp every day. And it's a remembrance of God's faithfulness to overcome the Antichrist, right, Antiochus, and God's miracle to let that olive oil last for 8 days until they had more consecrated olive oil. So Hanukkah is often called the Festival of Light, and that's why it's called the Festival of Light. But that's what it is commemorating, is that event in history. Well, after that, they actually did throw off the kingdom. And so I'm going to fudge this just a little bit. So basically from 164 BC until the Romans showed up in 63 BC, so for about 100 years, and this is a map of what it looked like, they first conquered Judea, and then successive generations, they conquered all this area, restoring the nation of Israel under a Jewish king. So they, for 100 years, had their independence until the Romans showed up. This is called the Hasmonean period. That's the name of that dynasty. You could have called it the Maccabean dynasty, but it's not what it's called. And so with Judas and then all the descendants of their family, the high priests, that 100-year rule came to be known as the Hasmonean dynasty, and it is an era of Jewish rule. And so if you think about it, in Jesus' time, right, it was only 63 years before Jesus was born that they were actually independent. And so, again, I want you to, when you read, as we get to Christmas and you read the Christmas story and you see Jesus as the Messiah and you wonder why the Jews don't recognize this, this is what's in their mind. The Hasmoneans minted coins. You don't see anybody's face on that coin because Jews didn't do that. You make no images, no graven images, no idols. But they did mint coins from that time that they ruled this area until 63 BC when Pompey and the Roman Empire came to be ascendant. So that's kind of the what this vision is about. So we had Daniel's vision, and what we were able to do when it was explained that it was going to be Alexander the Great, then four kings, then out of one of them is going to be another king, and he's going to think he's God, and he's going to be an antichrist. And that's why there's just not much doubt about this historically. That vision is about this guy, Antiochus, and he really is a precursor to the antichrist. You'll see a lot of this same language in the book of Revelation. And so this vision is saying to the Jews, and the reason is, you're going to fall on some hard times, and I want you to know that I, God, am telling you ahead of time which kingdoms are going to rule, so that when it happens, you will know that I am God, not these kings. And I'm going to tell you that there is going to be a period of time when you are going to have a king who's going to try to wipe you out, and he is going to be overthrown and broken, and I am going to do it. And so as they go through the hard times, the purpose of these prophecies is to remind them, particularly the people of the time, to remind them that, you know what, despite what it seems like, our God really is God. That's why the book of Revelation, fast forward to Christians, the book of Revelation isn't read a ton today. It was read all the time by persecuted Christians. Why? Because it is the vision that says God is the one that's in control, and he will tell you how it's going to play out. Amen? So, what happened to Antiochus? It was pathetic. Antiochus, the guy who thought he was something. So, the reason that they were able to throw off the soldiers is Antiochus was busy on his eastern kingdom. He's got enemies too. And he's not really a strong king. He thought a lot of himself, but he wasn't really very good at the thing. And so the Persians decide, I think we could take this guy. And the Persians rebel, think Iran. And so he takes off for Iran. He hasn't got time to worry about what's happening in Judea. And he loses Judea, right, in 164. But in 164, he's fighting the Persians. He is getting his tail whipped by them. And he is so depressed, he gets sick, and the book of Maccabees will give you all the gruesome details, but let's just say he dies a very cowardly, painful, pathetic death, which kind of seems fitting in the end. So that's the end of Antiochus, and that's the end of his godlike dreams, and that's the point of this vision, to remind them and to remind us that no matter how dark things seem, and trust me, it was pretty dark under Antiochus. I mean, it was brutal. I mean, think Nazi concentration camps and maybe more brutal than that. I mean, it was horrific. And yet, God says, evil has its season, but evil won't prevail. And that's still true today. And that's the central message of Daniel. Well, next time, I want to take a time out because, as I told you, during this time period, the Jews are reaching out to God. It's during this time period that the Pharisees get kicked off. The people like Mattathias that are not willing to sacrifice are called Hasids. Have you ever heard of Hasidic Judaism? Hasid is somebody who is seriously devoted to God. Out of these Hasids, it was just a title that was given to the people, like, well, those are the devout people. They won't worship even if you kill them. They're not going to worship Antiochus. Out of those Hasids come the Pharisees in the time of Jesus, the ultra committed to follow God. And so what we're seeing that Daniel is mapping out, by the time we get to the end of Daniel, we're going to realize, wait a minute, God is mapping out the end times, but he's also mapping out literally the road that leads to Jesus. And so next week we'll take a time out and look at some of the things the Jews were writing at this time. You get some wild things being written. You get some great things being written. You get the Dead Sea Scrolls being copied. All these things are happening. So we'll take a time out from the visions to talk about that. Our last two visions are probably the most phenomenal visions, and they're the ones that tie the most into Revelation. So I feel like after the last two visions, we should be pretty confident to point out the Antichrist. So I'll see you then.